From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made at a wedding, a fictional wedding between a rat and an aardvark. On the season premiere of the PBS kids show Arthur, Arthur and his friends attend the wedding of their teacher, Mr. Ratburn. Prior to the wedding, they had played matchmaker for their third grade teacher, hoping to help him find love. And he did, with his partner, a chocolatier named Patrick. The episode, Mr. Ratburn and the Special Someone, is the latest in a series of children's programs and books to highlight diverse characters and storylines. Production teams and authors on a variety of platforms have emphasized same-sex relationships, biracial relationships, characters who have disabilities, and characters who are in foster care, who are homeless, or who have extenuating circumstances that face many children and families, but are often not portrayed in the media. In July, a new PBS kids show called Molly of Denali will debut on WXXI-TV. It's the first ever series to feature an Alaska Native main character, and its production team includes Alaska Natives. The show reflects ongoing efforts to increase the number of underrepresented voices across all forms of media, but especially in children's media, where the social and emotional learning goals are geared toward combating stigma and teaching acceptance. This hour, we explore the state of inclusion in children's media with our guests, who also help us understand why it's important for kids to see characters and storylines that reflect them and their lives. I'd like to welcome our guests for the hour. On the line with us is Leslie Rotenberg, Chief Programming Executive and General Manager for Children's Media and Education at PBS. Leslie, welcome. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
It's great to have you. Also with us in studio, our colleague Kara Rager is here, Manager of Educational Training and Family Engagement at WXXI Education. It's nice to see you in my digs.
I know. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you, and it's great to have Leslie C. Youngblood, author of a book called Love Like Sky that we loved talking about here. It's out now. Nice to see you here.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure.
Well, I'm going to start with Leslie Rotenberg. You know, we mentioned Arthur off the top here. We actually had calls, Leslie, from other commercial television news and the local media after the episode aired asking any complaints locally. Now, Kara Rager is telling me, in fact, it's sort of the opposite, right, Kara, that after that episode aired, it was all positive.
Yeah, no, in the community, we have heard some really positive responses from families, from different community groups, so I've only heard positive responses.
Which is great. Leslie Rotenberg, what did PBS hear about that?
We heard so many positive responses from families who felt like for the very first time they saw their own family reflected on PBS, and children whose parents might be two moms or two dads and who might be going to schools where, you know, they have never seen themselves and their families reflected. And, you know, they were so grateful that we gave them the opportunity to see that on television. And it's really something that is very important for us, that every child can see themselves in our characters and reflected on PBS, and that they feel like it's a place that welcomes them.
Leslie, if this were the 1980s, sort of in the days where there was a lot of press for the so-called moral majority and a lot of the backlash against that kind of programming, it would probably be a different story. But there's certainly, you can find tweets, you can find social media people complaining about it. How much have you felt that change over the years? And then, frankly, how much does it matter? I mean, if you had a lot of complaints about Arthur, would it matter to PBS?
Of course it matters. I mean, we really, you know, we're public media, and our goal is that everyone feels that they are welcome and a part of our programming, and we take viewer complaints and calls very, very seriously. We feel deep responsibility to the community, whatever community it is. And I would say that we, you know, received a wide variety, a variety of reactions to the episode. You know, as Kara mentioned, there was a lot of positive support for this, as well as viewers that we heard from who did not appreciate the episode.
So this hour, you know, we're going to be talking about what is changing in representation. Sometimes it's the actual representation of character. Sometimes it's life circumstances. It's changing when it comes to what we see libraries presenting, when it comes to books and characters, which Leslie Youngblood's going to talk about. But I want to talk a little bit about Molly of Denali. And Kara Rager told me before the program began, you've had a chance to see it. It's coming our way in July?
Yeah, July 15th.
So What do you think, by the way?
It's awesome. What's not to love about it? I mean, aside from how authentic the series itself is, I think that it's so kids, no matter where what their background is, they're going to see themselves in the curiosity aspect of it. But the fact that it is to its core authentic with Alaskan Natives creating and developing the storylines, talking about their ancestral history and how that's present in their culture today, I think that speaks to so many people. I mean, because tradition is so part of everyone's life that I think that a lot of our families that have seen snips of it already are super jazzed about it as well.
Leslie Rotenberg, before we listen to a little clip from Molly of Denali, tell me a little bit about Molly.
Well, Molly is a very feisty girl. She's going to appeal to a broad range of viewers. You know, first of all, she is the first children's lead character who is Native American. So in addition to being Alaska Native, you know, we think that Native American children who living all across the country are going to relate to her. But she also lives a very rural life. And so she spends a lot of time outdoors, spends a lot of time with animals, which, first of all, every child loves animals for the most part and will relate to that. But also we have so many kids watching who live in rural communities, and they're going to see their way of life reflected as well. She's curious about the world, and she has deep relationships with her family that you'll see, and a lot of respect for elders that I think, again, regardless of your culture, I think that there are universal themes that children across America will relate to.
Let's listen to a clip of Molly of Denali. Molly discovers in this clip a raven is in trouble.
Molly, shine the flashlight up there.
Is that...
It's Dotson. Raven, look!
He's staring right at us.
And dropping stones on our roof.
He'll keep us up all night with that rabbit.
Can I take some crackers and try luring him away from the house?
I'm not sure that will work, Molly.
Then how do we get him off our roof?
A raven may be mischievous, but sometimes mischief conceals a larger purpose. Maybe instead of chasing him away, we should pay attention to why he's here.
But why is he here?
That's a question that'll have to wait. It's getting late. Time for you to go to bed.
There's a clip from Molly of Denali. Leslie Rotenberg from PBS, you want to weigh in on some of what you're hearing there?
Yeah, well, what you just played is from the Molly of Denali podcast, which is an exciting new innovation for us. It's a prequel to the series, and folks can listen to it now, even though the series hasn't started running yet on WXXI. But you can download the podcast, and it's a great way to get to know the character and to get to know the storyline. And it also gives you a good sense of how Native American culture, symbolism, and language are reflected, and thus the significance of the raven in stories that are passed down from generation to generation that you just heard. And you know, you get a sense of how fun the characters are in the storyline. It's full of adventure, and you'll see a lot more of that in the television series.
Kara Rager was mentioning before the program that what we are seeing on WXXI, what we're seeing from PBS, is also something that you aim to reflect in the community when you're holding events, because you're doing a lot of work in this community, and representation matters here. How do you do that?
So we couldn't exist and do our outreach work without partners. So by finding partners that are serving families all across our viewing area in spaces where we may not be, right? We may be on their television, we may be on their tablet, but they don't see us physically. And going into those communities with a partner kind of gives you a little bit more clout, too, to someone to vouch for you. We spend a lot of time with libraries for that reason. So working with the Monroe County Library System, the City Library branches, and the Pioneer Library System, because they're serving very specific neighborhoods. They're serving very specific communities. They might have multi-generational programming that they do. Like, we can then customize our outreach work based on the needs of their families that live there, as opposed to just assuming that we know what families need.
The reason I ask that is because sometimes there is, a justifiable concern that representation, it becomes sort of tokenism. Like, well, there's going to be one show with one character and, you know, everything else stays the same. Whereas with PBS, WXXI, we're seeing it in the programming, we're seeing it in individual shows, we're seeing it in storylines, we're seeing it in events in the community. I mean, this has been a real conscious and intentional effort. And we mentioned Molly of Denali. When can people see Molly of Denali, by the way?
Molly of Denali premieres on July 15th. It's going to air at 8:30 in the morning and at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and then on the WXXI Kids channel at 7:30.
So that's coming your way. I want to listen to a clip as well with a character named Lily from Sesame Street. Now, Sesame Street has seen some change. And before we kind of talk to Kara and Leslie Rotenberg, I want to ask Leslie Youngblood, when you're growing up and you're thinking about the world and accessing different forms of media, if a show like Sesame Street, you know, look, the diversity was in the puppets and in the big birds, but right. if you're not feeling like there are themes that really affect everybody, if it's narrow in scope, if there are kids' cartoon shows that are either mostly white or narrow in scope, what is it? Does it feel like parts of the community are excluded? What's going on there, Liz?
Well, it is the case that parts of mm-hmm. the community are excluded if they are not represented there. And I think not only do I like the ideal of Molly of Denali having this authentic character, but the behind the scenes.
Yeah, that's a great point.
And I think mm-hmm. that's what we need. Kids not only need representation on a cover of the book, it's something validating for them to know that the author of that book represents where they're from, you know, looks like them, looks like people they know. So that's also something, not only the cover, but also the writers, the authors of these works.
I think that is a really interesting point. Tell me a little bit more about your thoughts on that, Leslie Rotenberg. Representation, not just who we see as viewers.
Yeah, you know, I'm so glad that the other Leslie mentioned this, because it's such an important part of Molly of Denali, and it's something that I would say we learned along the way of producing it, is that it was really important that we were not going in and telling the stories of this other culture, but instead that this culture was becoming a part of the production and we were co-creating. And so I'm really proud of the production itself and the fact that there was a group of advisors that we worked with from the very beginning of the show. In Alaska, and Alaska Native voices are included in every aspect of the production, on the camera, behind the scenes. Every Indigenous character is voiced by an Indigenous actor. The stories themselves came from the community. They are authentic stories, as Kara mentioned. We had Alaska Native screenwriters and producers working and continuing to work to bring the series to life, training children to do the voiceovers, training producers, so that this is something. These are skills that they will be able to maintain and continue after this series and bring to hopefully other artistic works in the future. And so there's a lot of authenticity in the show itself. You know, and as Leslie said, the authors of these stories are from this community.
So July 15th for the premiere on WXXI TV of Molly of Denali. I do think Sesame Street is a show that has been better than most in terms of actual on-screen representation, but maybe some of the actual storylines and themes have gotten a little richer and more textured. What do you see there, Kara Rager?
Absolutely. I would say, I mean, I definitely grew up watching Sesame Street, and you learn so much from the characters themselves, but as an educator, you know, now that I'm older and I am working with educators themselves, I'm working with parents, I'm working with caregivers, with kids, the resources that Sesame has created that are much more true to life, you know, having access to a character that is dealing with homelessness, having resources that use those Sesame characters and go past what the kids are watching on the television screen and go, okay, how do we support their educators who know that they have kids in their classrooms or in their learning spaces that are dealing with trauma? You know, are there ways that we can take those characters and that might have the hook that kids are hooked with that we can then use and create activities, create support tools, even just create language that we can use with families that is familiar? You know, one of the things we know about PBS Kids and Sesame Street, those kind of series, is that families are comfortable with them, especially when they see themselves in the series themselves. They are comfortable. They have this like warm, fuzzy, you know, relatable feeling when it comes to those series. And so we don't have to convince a grown-up that that's friendly and approachable and education focused. So it's easier to have tougher conversations with those resources. And I think being more authentic with series like this, where everyone involved in it is from the Native experience or from the culture that it's representing, mm-hmm. Will just add to that value. And I've seen that when working with educators, when working with parents, the resources kind of speak for themselves.
Well, let's listen to a clip. This is Elmo and Sophia asking Lily why she said,
"You know, Lily, sometimes when Elmo talks about his feelings, it makes Elmo feel better."
Well, it's just that, well, my bedroom is purple, and purple's my favorite color, and it reminds me of my bedroom. And, well, we don't have our own apartment anymore, and we've been staying in all different kinds of places.
Lily, no matter where you are, always remember. The thing about home is more than a house or an apartment. Home is really where the love is. That's why you and your parents are staying with me for a while. And we're gonna make sure that no matter what, there's always lots of love.
Yeah, love.
I mean, Leslie Rotenberg, that's a heavy subject that may surprise some
people. It is. And, you know, I mean, first of all, I think that it's important to say that Sesame Street broke new ground in children's media 50 years ago when it started, and it continues to. When it started, it had an inner city set and an integrated cast, and those things were considered pretty revolutionary at the time. I think they continue to stay on top of what the needs of children are today. And there are times when they introduce a character, like the character who has autism, where it makes sense to introduce that character on television, and that all children need to see characters like that and to need to understand whether they're autistic, or they know someone who's autistic, or they're just in a classroom with kids who are autistic. They understand a little bit more about what that's like and how to get along with somebody like that. In this case, you're talking about a character who may not be featured on the television series, but is featured in materials that are created specifically for children who are homeless and are being used in those specific circumstances. So like you said, if it's a heavy subject and it may not be maybe scary or upsetting to kids, it may not be a character that is actually integrated into the television series itself, but it's used in these resources, as Kara mentioned, that are very, very specifically targeted to the needs of a specific community where there's trust, and the opportunity to have a Muppet character that kids can relate to really helps them to break through to some very difficult topics.
Well, and Leslie C. Youngblood's book, Love Like Sky, is a textured portrayal. And I said this when you were on talking about the book. I love the color. I love seeing a young black girl on the cover of a book, proudly displayed on the cover.
Definitely.
An African-American author. And then some subjects that, you know, you have to tackle some things that can be a little heavy, knowing that, you know, this is the world that we live in. And if we are so siloed and narrow, you're only reaching sort of a narrow population. What was your goal with a book like this?
You know, one is to use it as a tool for teachers. As Kara was saying, teachers need that entry to talk to a student, primarily with Love Like Sky. We're talking about a loss of a sibling. We're talking about divorce. So one of the goals was just to have that representation for kids who are going through divorce. And how many students does that represent? Unfortunately, several, 50% of divorces, 50% of marriages end in divorce. So that's just a flat stat. But when we're talking about a kid and why they have the learning disability, or why they aren't doing as well in school, what is the reason behind that? Mm-hmm. The reason could be divorce. And Love Like Sky talks about that.
Well, I want to say to Leslie Rotenberg, as we got to let her go for time here, the Chief Programming Executive and General Manager for Children's Media and Education at PBS here, helping lead the way, I think, with this kind of representation. We're proud to be your partners here. I know we're excited about Molly of Denali, but so many other projects, ongoing shows and efforts. And Leslie, thanks for the insight on what PBS is doing.
Thank you, and we appreciate you focusing on this important topic.
You got it. That is Leslie Rotenberg taking time with us here. If you're just joining us, you're hearing Leslie C. Youngblood in studio with us, author of Love Like Sky. Kara Rager is here, manager of educational training and family engagement right here at WXXI Education. You know, Kara, I want to kind of piggyback off what Leslie Youngblood's talking about, whether it's the book, whether it's Sesame Street. Sometimes I think parents are curious to know where what kids can either handle or what's appropriate. I've always felt like, and I know I sound like a homer, I've always felt like Sesame Street is doing it in a way that is, for lack of a better word, safe, or but also not shying away from. The clip we just played is safe. It's about love. But it's for children who, like my kid, is not going to experience homelessness. But I want him to see that in the world, those things are real, too. It's not just for kids
right.
who maybe not represented before. I think it should be for everybody.
Absolutely. It adds the rest of the story, right? If you haven't experienced this, you don't know about it. And so it takes that stigma away that it's weird or unusual. It makes it not, I don't want to say it makes it normal because you don't want homelessness to be normal, but it makes them able to relate more to their peers. It's reality. And so our books, our television series, our media, it should be reflective of the communities that we live in. And so I think that by having starting places, right, by having PBS Kids series, by having books, by having resources that parents can lean on and go like, wow, this is a tough topic. You don't have to know the answers, but these tools are available for me to use as resources, I think really adds to the discussion. And to your point, all of these things are being created in developmentally appropriate ways, right? So it is appropriate to have a conversation with a five-year-old about something tough because it's framed in a way that's appropriate for them to understand. It's not way above their head. You know, that's the point. And that's the work that PBS Kids and Sesame Street and groups like that are doing, is so that it's not so unrealistic to have a conversation that is tough about, you know, food insecurity. That's big. That's really big. Adults have a hard time talking about that. But when you bring it down to an appropriate level, kids can also talk about that.
I think it's such a great point. But here's where I think, as an observer, I'm hoping to hear good news on this. Because when Leslie Youngblood was on the program talking about the release of Love Like Sky, I had just been in the Pittsburgh Barnes & Noble. Huge display of the book. Again, that beautiful cover there. They're proudly displaying this book. These themes... A young black girl on the cover, beautiful artwork, PBS programming. They're going in directions that are, I think, would have been considered more bold or daring a generation ago. The question is, does a publisher feel like that book's going to sell? Does PBS, can they be comfortable that people will tune in if they go in these directions? And Leslie, we talked about this. I mean, the publishing industry, there's gatekeepers trying to convince them that this product's going to move. How is it going so far?
Well, it's going fine so far. Now, I have to be honest, when the book was initially, when we were in the publication stage or the drafting stage, the initial image was not the beautiful black girl. It was a big heart. And marketing told me, point blank, that will sell better. That is more generic. That is not going to deter people from making them believe that it's a black book. And what happened was when they sent me the original, some drafts, I mean, it's Disney, you know, it's published by Disney Hyperion, Disney Books. So I was a little I was taken aback, but eventually I said, hey, this is, I don't love this cover. The big heart is not what this book represents. And then we went back to the drawing board, Vashti Harrison, the illustrator. And so here's the final product. But I do believe that mentality is still out there. People still may believe that it's a black book, but that is more speaking to that person's mentality. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure, and I'll probably never know. Well, I definitely will not know how the book would have sold.
Sure.
Right.
But see, that's not my concern, though, because the people that embrace it, those little black girls, those little black boys, and even... any person of color, non-person of color, who wants to learn about this child, mm-hmm. who wants to experience that, this book is for them. And so in my heart, it would always do well.
How do you feel about that on the television side?
And I agree. But I think that it's not perfect. It's never going to be perfect. Mm-hmm. There's always something to strive for. And I think that even us in public media, like, we're not perfect with it. We don't have perfect partners. We're constantly looking for more partners. We don't have a perfect partner group, I guess. We have a great big system of partners that we've created, but that's not done. Like, we still are constantly looking for more partners and more spaces. Same thing with these PBS Kids shows. There are some really wonderful series that are doing a great job of having representation, but PBS Kids has been around for a long time, and Molly of Denali is brand new. And so leading up to that, we haven't had quite as an authentic series that is to its core representing, you know, a cultural group like that. Now, I think that one piece to piggyback off of what Leslie said is kids are a great group to create resources for, because unless they've been fed information and warped perspectives, and a child will pick up Leslie's book,
yes,
and go, this looks amazing. This, there's a girl on this. I'm interested in this. It doesn't matter what they look like. They're I love to read. I'm going to read about this little girl. And it's going to add so much more to the story about young girls, young kids.
Right. It's usually the parents who say, oh, well, I may know someone. There's their 11-year-old daughter standing there. They'll look at the book. I know someone who I can give this to.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you know, what about your child?
Right.
You know, and but the young girl will walk toward it. And I definitely think it's important. And I have to mention Dr. Rudine Sims Bishop. She wrote an amazing essay back in 1990 titled Mirrors, Windows, and Sliding Glass Doors. And so when we're all mentioning we need mirrors for young kids, we need windows, we need these sliding glass doors for them to walk into someone else's life, someone else's perspective, that's mainly what we're referencing. It's been paraphrased so many times, but kids need mirrors. They need someone that looks like them. Mm-hmm. Then they need these windows to see the world and step into that world. And then that takes us into empathy. How do we empathize? And that's important. And that's what, especially in my genre, middle grade fiction, that's targeting 8 to 12-year-olds. Mm. This is the time where if they're not experiencing homelessness, if their parents are happily married, and they will never be children of divorced parents, a book can take them there and make them understand that this is not, you know, we don't want it to be normal, but this is someone else's experience.
Yeah, and I think that's exactly the great, like watching Molly of Denali come out and PBS be very excited about it, I think it's a similar kind of space where PBS has gone, you know what, this is important for us to do. If we want to be relevant to all families, we need to create something that's going to let kids do that, that are not from a native background, that are not, you know, surrounded by oral tradition every day. How do we give kids an experience like that so they have an appreciation for all of that aspects of that, you know, that person's life?
Now, kids need to be validated, and that's what books do and television programs mm-hmm. do. But it can work the opposite way. It can make them feel less than, devalued if they only see the majority, quote unquote majority culture on television. Mm-hmm. What about me? Where am I? And that's what my books and books by many other people of color, we work and think of that every day.
I want to get one email in before we get to break, if we could. Adam just wants to know, what about Bert and Ernie? Heard that they came out. So, all right, so we're going to do this. We're doing this. And I wish we had Leslie Rotenberg here, but we don't. But let me go ahead and just hit this topic here. Because back in September, almost a year ago, the internet was sort of buzzing with this idea that Bert and Ernie were romantic partners. And a former Sesame Street writer who is gay said in an interview that he wrote Bert and Ernie intentionally as a loving couple, taking inspiration from his own relationship with his longtime partner. Mark Saltzman was his name, and he said, I always felt that without a huge agenda, when I was writing Bert and Ernie, they were gay. And then Sesame Workshop, the nonprofit behind Sesame Street, came out saying, no, Bert and Ernie are best friends, being that they are puppets. They do not have sexual orientation. Saltzman later said he thought his comments were misinterpreted. So all I'm going to say about that is this, and I'm very curious to hear what my colleague Kara Rager says. I'm watching the Harry Potter situation with J.K. Rowling, and J.K. Rowling is now saying, oh, you know, when you look back, a certain character was gay. I'm trying to remember if it was Dumbledore or I didn't remember. But the bottom line is J.K. Rowling saying, oh, yeah, yeah, because there was all these rumblings for years about the Harry Potter. I don't think you get credit for retroactively going back and saying that a character was gay. If they weren't out and it wasn't, you know, part of just the fabric of their lives and the stories you're creating, you don't get inclusive credit for saying, yeah, yeah, that one that we never really talked about, they were sort of closeted, but yeah, they were gay. I sort of feel like, no offense to J.K. Rowling, I sort of feel like that was the case there. Whereas Sesame Street is saying, look, they're just puppets. Like, you can speculate. I'm more down with Sesame Street saying, no, and here's why. How do you feel about it?
Yeah, no. So it's interesting. I actually read the Jim Henson biography. And I love that they're best friends. I love that they have this super strong bond, that they act kind of like brothers, that they're complete opposites. And I think that if Sesame Street had intentionally created characters who were LGBTQ, and maybe they will, hopefully they will, because that'd be amazing. I think that would be wonderful. But I think that going back on that and just hoping that people interpret them, it doesn't give authenticity to that entire population of people who want to look to characters in this series. I don't think it does it enough justice. I think just saying that they might have been or that they were isn't as good. It's not good enough.
Yeah, that's kind of where I am with the Harry Potter stuff.
Personally. I can't speak for Sesame
Workshop. I don't know that you get credit for that. Let's go ahead and take our only break now of the hour. And when we come back, we're going to welcome Ed Popiel, who is also, you might know Ed Popiel as Mrs. Kasha Davis, who has done some remarkable performing locally, nationally. Look, Mrs. Kasha Davis is a star. Ed's also written a book about, you know, just being your true self as a child in a family that may have questions about that. So we're going to talk to Ed about representation in media, and he'll have some things to say there. Leslie C. Youngblood is here. Her book is Love Like Sky. And I am not an official endorser for the station, but I think Megan Mack and I like Leslie so much that I remember when we read the book, we were going, boy, I hope it's good. And we talked to each other and said, it's really a remarkable book. And it's a powerful story. Love Like Sky is the book. Kara Rager is here, Manager of Educational Training and Family Engagement at WXXI Education. Let's go ahead and get that break and come right back here on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Friday on The Next Connections, conservatives join us in the first hour to talk about how Republicans can win in 2020. You heard Democrats and progressives having that same debate on the program earlier this week. Now we hear how Republicans are trying to win in 2020. In our second hour, Christopher Albrecht, who is the reigning New York State Teacher of the Year, concluding his year with the title, What He's Learned in the Last Year. Talk with you Friday. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Before I bring in Ed, Mrs. Kasha Davis, just to kind of put a fine point on the Harry Potter thing, we should just keep things rolling during the breaks because most of the conversations, they're really interesting and they most would not cause me to lose my employment. And you'd really like to hear what people are saying in the studio. Leslie, you were saying during the break that on the Harry Potter thing, you've also heard discussion on characters like Hermione that maybe they were actually a character of color?
That's what I've heard. And I don't know any of the details, but I've seen it on Twitter. And there's also a book by Ebony Elizabeth Thomas that is called The Dark Fantastic that talks about representation of people of color in fantasy books. And I'm sure she goes into it. Unfortunately, I haven't read it yet. But I've heard that she's a person of color.
But if 7 books later, the author comes back and says, oh, yeah, that actually was a person of color, but you didn't know it as a reader. What do you think?
It's like you were saying, I don't know if you still get that credit or is more of letting people use their imagination or think what they will, but there is something to be said of someone that may stand a chance of losing some of their quote-unquote fan base and just saying and writing that person boldly as a person of color. And apparently, if we're still debating it how many years later, whether is she or is she not, but people are looking for representation. So I can imagine a black girl saying, who loves Harry Potter, looking to latch on to something. And that may be the case here. I don't know.
No, yeah. I hear that. All I'm going to say is I also understand those who might say, well, Evan, how come your default assumption is all the Harry Potter characters are white unless told otherwise? Number one, I'm a white guy, mm-hmm. and I make assumptions, and I'm aware of that. Mm-hmm. But also, in the media promoting it, there's plenty of imagery media that did make that indication, too. So if J.K. Rowling wanted to go against the media representation, she would have had to be more overt, is
right.
what I'm saying. Yeah.
So, especially in the movies. I was just going to say, too, I think there is actually a young woman, I want to say she's from Philadelphia, somewhere in Pennsylvania maybe, that did interpret Hermione as a young black girl. And she herself is a black young lady. And she was remaking her own version of what Hermione was like
That's
on video. I don't know all the details of it, but I remember when that all that information came out that like possibly that character mm-hmm. Was not white, that this young lady was like, yeah, and I'm going to do this with it. So,
well, I definitely studies show that when a person reads a text and if there's no quote unquote racial clues, people default to white.
Yeah.
And that's unfortunate. And it's also something to be said when you have a protagonist in a book that protagonist is black, the secondary characters or people of color, and not just a not just the person of color being a secondary character mm-hmm. or a character without any real say-so in the book. That's important to note. Like in Love, Light, Sky, not only is our protagonist black, but her friends, and that is a life that a lot of people don't experience. You may get one black person in a book and to fill that void of mm-hmm. not having any people of color. And that's different from a protagonist having agency moving throughout the book mm-hmm. and making change. And we don't have that often enough.
Well, let me bring in someone who's on the line with us, who is a Rochesterian who's out on the West Coast right now. Ed Popiel, you know Ed as Mrs. Kasha Davis, a local award-winning drag, a national award-winning drag performer, children's book author, and just really just a fabulous person. Ed, how are you? What's going on?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Very
Thanks
good.
For calling.
So tell us what Mrs. Kasha Davis is doing on the West Coast.
Well, I'm out here right now. I'm doing some filming with our parent company for RuPaul's Drag Race, the production company called World of Wonder. And I'm teaming up with a fellow named Brock McGillis, who is the first out Canadian hockey, pro hockey player. And he does a lot of work with students, athletes in middle school and high school and college levels, you know, essentially saying that it's okay to be gay and play sports. You know, surprise, you know, and so it's fascinating to me. He and I just sort of collided in the idea that we both work with the youth and are passionate about providing those examples. And so we're putting together this video, sort of series that, continues to, you know, showcase that fact that you're not alone. If you're out there and you're a little bit different growing up, there's a place for you.
How to be your genuine self. I love it. So you and Brock McGillis are doing these videos. When are people going to be able to see them?
You know what? We're just finishing up. We've got two more to do today, and then production, they should be out in the next few weeks. And, of course, you know, social media, I'll have it posted everywhere. So.
Follow Mrs. Kasha Davis, and you will see, I'm sure, all about that. That sounds I love the theme. And I got to say, Ed, as well, you know, Kara and I were talking before the program began. I think Kara even brought it up before she knew you were going to be on the program about what local libraries have done.
Oh, the Irondequoit Library. Before we even got to the table today, we were talking about possibly having someone from the Irondequoit Public Library to come on and talk about drag story times. And Evan was like, oh, my God, that's our guest.
So you want to tell us about how that's gone?
Well, I'll tell you, I worked with the Irondequoit Public Library, and we did two different times where we did drag story time. One, it was part of the Fringe Festival, and it was in the Rochester location of the public library. And then we did one at the Irondequoit Public Library, and they went swimmingly. It was very positive. We started to get some protesters, you know, based off one of the local radio shows, and people started to get a little angry, but they never showed up. Now, fast forward, I've been doing Drag Story Hour at Blackfriars Theater, and our numbers continue to grow. Our last one, we had several hundred people, and I posted a video of that out on YouTube as well, and it's just incredible. I think partially because of the fact that we're at the theater, we have avoided some of the protesters. And in that respect, I think that enables us to be able to be, you know, less targeted, unfortunately.
So how
it's,
do you...
It's sad to say.
Let me talk a little bit about the targeting and the notion that there are protesters at all. Ed, how do you respond? What's your decision like on how to respond, if you respond at all, when you either meet someone who's protesting or someone sends you a note that they don't like Drag Story Hour, they don't like this idea of kids experiencing this. Take me through your mindset and what you think is productive there.
You know, I first think that the most productive thing we need to do is listen to each other. I am not the purpose of what we do with Drag Story Hour, and the intent is not necessarily understood, I believe, by some of the individuals that are protesting. Understandably so. They get an image in their head and they think immediately we're forcing, gender fluidity and or sexuality, ours, on someone else or their children, which is absolutely not the intent, at least for the ones that I am involved with. What we do is we encourage people, the children and the adults in the audience, children of all ages, I like to say, that if they should see somebody who happens to be different, no matter what that means, yes, it could be gender, it could be sexuality, it could be glasses, it could be, you know, physical appearance, skin color, et cetera, to treat that person with kindness. Mm-hmm. And so I beg those individuals that are protesting to come back at that concept at that point, because there's a perception that it's something more than that. And if they attended, they would see that it is different. Obviously, I'm standing there in drag, and I have been interviewed, and people have asked, why aren't you explaining why you're in drag? And the answer that came right to my head was, because the children never asked. They don't have a question.
Yeah.
That's Mrs. Kasha Davis. So if the question was asked, we would address it, but they're not asking the question. It's the adult at home behind the keyboard who's not there, who's making this judgment, who has no idea what is actually happening. And what's happening is, for me, and why I'm so passionate about it, is when I was a child, I felt so different. And my parents tried to help me fit in. And I know that now, that their intent was to protect me and help me be safe. But I felt so isolated and so alone because I realized now I was gay. I felt I just needed to express a flamboyant side. I didn't know that that meant drag at the time as a child. I just liked things to be fancy. I don't know what that meant. I just liked it. And so I was kept from myself and from the world and had to hide. And unfortunately, when that happens, we are then rendering ourselves terminally unique and nobody else is like me. And then terrible things happen, whether it's, you know, depression, suicide, substance abuse. Unfortunately, we hear the stories of suicide because people feel so alone. So if we can be that example out in the world that is, I'm here, I'm healthy, I'm happy, and I'm different, and that's okay. Mm. Where is that a problem? So I'm obviously a little bit passionate about it at this point. I'm seeing stuff that I think is just a perception that is an extreme, and maybe it's because of a visual that some people have seen, or the fact that it's in a public library and they're saying our funding shouldn't be going here. And then I'll see a comment that says you're shoving it down our throats. Well, no, you don't have to go.
That's right. That is true. But I have heard, by the way, that kids love Mrs. Kasha Davis and thinks that she lives at Blackfriars.
Yes. Some of the kids have said, well, I just love Mrs. Kasha Davis. Their parents will say they'll play a game and they're like, well, I'm going to be Mrs. Kasha Davis. She lives at Blackfriars Theater and she looks fabulous and she reads books.
I love that.
That's what she does.
Well, I love what you said before about how kids didn't ask. Right? You're being very mindful of the fact that, like, what are they asking about? What are they curious about? And because you've become part of their day-to-day life as a regular event that they may participate in, it's not weird. It's just part of their day-to-day life. So it's not unusual.
Right.
And so now it's part of their play, which I think speaks volumes to what you're doing. You've been able to open up their view of what people do, who people are, what people look like, and now it's part of their play, and that's how they process. That's huge.
Well, and so let me ask you, Ed, on the PBS side, we were talking about the fact that the show Arthur, in its, I think it was the season debut this time around, mm-hmm. wasn't it, Kara?
Yep.
Not too long ago, the current season, the first episode of the season, and Arthur what animal is Arthur again?
He's an aardvark.
He's an aardvark, of course. I just know this. I mean, Arthur. So the episode was called Mr. Ratburn and the Special Someone. And in the episode, Arthur and his friends attend the wedding of their teacher, Mr. Ratburn, to his partner, a chocolatier named Patrick. And here at WXXI, Kara was saying, and I've already heard internally in the building, We didn't get a single complaint, but there was a lot of wonderful feedback about a same-sex wedding, the kids celebrating it. PBS National told us this hour that, yeah, you get some complaint, but boy, it's been really, really positive. What do you think the impact is? And I'm asking you to go back in time a little bit, but you talked about your own growing up and how difficult it was at times thinking either I'm different or is there something wrong with it or, you know, my parents are trying to protect me, but, you know, that's who I am. Can it help a child to see an episode where there is a celebration of a same-sex wedding, where there are representations that aren't just sort of token characters, but really plot lines filled with love? What does that mean, Ed?
I think it means that there's a place for that child that may feel as though that may be a direction, or there's hope that it's just normal. People want to fit in, really, have a place. And I think initially the thought that I have is that they feel, you know, that they're a part of and not alone. And so this is why we have different groups and organizations where people can gravitate to. I have to say, while you were talking, bringing that up, I thought of my own family, and there's five of us, and three of us are gay. And so my brother said to me, he's like, you know, my children have only ever been to gay weddings. And they just, of course, you know, this is, you know, Uncle Ed and Uncle Steve and so on and so forth. And it doesn't even faze them. And at the wedding, they sat there and they were so happy. One of my favorite moments, because I absolutely, you know, love children, and I love just, obviously, you know, if I'm going to be doing Drag Story Hour, I hope to have a fondness for children. But so they're all the kids right in the front, and they're just watching, and they can just see the love that Steve and I have for one another as we're having our ceremony. And afterwards, they all asked for paper. And we're like, okay, we're at a restaurant. What do you need? They all drew us these cards and hearts and all of these things about, like, you know, so, and they're just little ones. And they needed to express what they felt and what they saw. And of course, kids, it's like, I want to draw. And they're, mm-hmm. you know, a little bored at the restaurant, you know, give them something to do, whatever. And we got all of the most amazing little notes and cards. And they drew, this, you know, the pictures of the two of us holding hands. And I thought, oh, my God, I never dreamt that that would be something that could ever happen. You know, it wasn't a gay wedding. It was a wedding.
Right.
Yeah.
I'm curious as to how do you think the show Modern Family, because at least kids have something on TV mm-hmm. that I don't, how do you feel about that show in general? Is it something that you think is helps kids with, you know, to know more about same-sex marriages?
Ed?
It just came to mind, Ed.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a cute representation. Mm-hmm. I think that what we're finding and what we realize more and more is that when advertising companies and or television shows begin to show same-sex marriages or individuals, I noticed, like, if you'll see, like, just a general commercial for, you know, how we have these prescription ones or whatever the case may be, and they'll show two people, two men or two women with a child. It's normalizing it for the world because it's on the media. You know, I was on flying out here, and in the Delta little commercial before I, you know, watch my movie, they show people all around the world showing how similar we are, and they're all having birthdays with children, and they show two same-sex marriages. And it's just those little glimpses like that help, I think, us to show that, you know, it's accepted and it's normal. And it always takes time. Things don't just change overnight.
I noticed that obviously. With interracial couples too. Mm-hmm. A lot of commercials have interracial couples. Yeah. So that's great.
Yeah. No, yeah. I mean,
and it's great. And I have a friend who's a local, she's one of our fabulous local actresses, Esther Winter. And she's married and an interracial couple. And she remembers when she never saw herself on a magazine or in television or her and her husband. And she says now that it's the first couple times they saw it, they were just in awe.
Mm. Well, that's, you know, real life.
To picture.
That's
so
true.
So right. Before we wrap the program, I've really appreciated the conversation. You may see Mrs. Kasha Davis The June 10th edition of New York Magazine, the 100 Most Powerful Drag Queens in America, and Mrs. Kasha Davis is right there, smack center. So congratulations there, Mrs. Kasha Davis. Where can people find your book, which is a nice story about your own experience, but really about kids being themselves? Where can people find your book, and where can they see you next, Ed?
Well, they can find the book on my website at mrskashadavis.com. It's called Little Eddie P. Wants to Be a Star. I'm excited to say that I'm book two is coming out, and the book talks about, kindness and depicts a series of different characters, much like what we're discussing today. And my next drag story hour is in Rochester at Blackfriars Theater on July 20th.
Thanks for the time, Ed, and we will see you back in Rochester. We really appreciate talking to Ed Popiel, Mrs. Kasha Davis. Thank you, Ed.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
And Love Like Sky, that beautiful book, is out now. Find it where? Where do you want people to find it?
Barnes & Noble, and we also have a new bookstore, Hippocampo, specializes in children's books, and that's, I believe, on South Avenue, and of course, always on anywhere books are sold.
I just got an email from the folks at Hippocampo, and that's a conversation we ought to have right here. So
yes,
they're all listening. Hey, Molly of Denali debuts on WXXI-TV.
Yep, July 15th.
July 15th. Thanks for the great work you do here, Kara Rager. Our colleague here at WXXI and Leslie C. Youngblood, the author of Love Like Sky, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Our thanks to Gary Putup behind the glass, Megan Mack, the producer and engineer today. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a great afternoon. Talk to you tomorrow on member-supported public radio.